This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, December 2nd, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. Zoning has shaped American cities since 1916, when New York City adopted the first comprehensive ordinance. What are the economic effects of zoning, both good and bad? William Fischel is author of Zoning Rules, The Economics of Land Use Regulation. We spoke following a forum for the book in October. What are most homeowners really concerned about when it comes to what goes on around them?
The thing that drives most homeowners is anxiety that something will change in the neighborhood that will adversely affect the value of their house or the projected value of their house. Now, I hasten to add that most homeowners, especially at public meetings, don't want to talk about money. They want to talk about things that map into money, like the quality of the schools, the amount of traffic, whether that's crime, air pollution, all those things. But we economists know, and indeed I think most homeowners know, that those things pretty clearly map into a dollar value. So that's why I think reducing it to the value is a useful shorthand.
Now, you talk in the book, speaking of that, you talk about the Coase theorem and its potential application as what, a replacement for zoning or as a sort of a supplement to zoning?
I think of it as a rationalization of zoning. So if you have a town that has a very large minimum lot sizes that are unreasonably so and you can't develop anything, the Coasean approach, which says, well, if you have an inefficient outcome and there's two parties who can bargain with one another, they should be able to make a deal. The landowner or the developer landowner should be able to ask the town, what do you need to rezone this so I can get attractive houses or a commercial center going? And smart landowners, in fact, developers do start that way these days.
They do.
Yes, it's not a hypothetical proposition.
Okay. Well, how does that go typically? Because I mean, the Coase theorem predicts these things, but people rarely bring up too many examples of that occurring in practice.
Well, the example it is rare because it is not easy to do. You have to have a good deal of experience and foresight to be able to do this. The example that I use in the book is a developer who bought land, 37 acres in West Lebanon, New Hampshire. The developer's name is David Clem. I hope he doesn't mind my using him as an example. And David was a very experienced developer, and he wanted to develop an office park for a high-tech mixed-use office park where there would be firms kind of like the ones in downtown Boston and Cambridge, which he had developed, and some commercial development and some residential development. So he went around. It's a 37-acre tract, but it's bordered on two sides by some existing houses. And David, after he bought the land, went around and knocked on doors himself, not with his lawyer in hand, not with his planners in hand, not with a retinue of people who answered to him, but just barely by himself and said, I want to do something with the land. What would you like in return? What kind of things can I do for you? Because I need your help to get this through. It turned out what they really wanted was the land bordered on the Connecticut River. The people in the neighborhood wanted access to the Connecticut River. It's a beautiful site, but it was over private land, undeveloped. They really couldn't go down and boat or picnic by the river. And so he said, I'll give it to you. In fact, I'll give it to you in perpetuity. I'll dedicate the land to a conservation easement. I'll even have you participate. And he got them all on their side. And his zoning just sailed through.
All right. I mean, that sounds like a happy example. You described the Coase theorem as a rationalization for zoning. But wouldn't some certain kinds of zoning actually prohibit that kind of transaction from taking place?
Well, many aspects of zoning laws do stand in the way. A lot of zoning proposes that zoning be based on a comprehensive plan. Now, I think comprehensive plan, all that really means is you're zoning the whole community for something or other. But planners think that they should be able to foresee what these developments are and that folks like David Clem should go on the land that they zoned industrial or mixed use or commercial and not just pick a pretty piece of land on the Connecticut River. So one part of the problem is that planning theory says, gee, the planners ought to have this far-seeing view of what's good for the community. And sometimes they do. I give credit to planners, a lot of credit. But a lot of times things change, technologies change, and the preferences of the community are not well known. And so you need to have some kind of change. And so planning and zoning sometimes stand in the way of change in ways that that you have to work around.
Jane Jacobs is a popular figure among libertarians when it comes to land development. And as she wrote in The Death and Life of American Cities, this is an organic process. What do you take or disagree with from her work when it comes to zoning and how that can impact development and rejuvenation of cities?
Yeah. Well, Jane Jacobs is one of my goddesses. I think extremely highly of her. Here is this woman who just took life as it came and made sense of it in ways that people who were just developing theories out of air could not make sense of. So I give maximum credit. The difficulty with Jacobs, I think, is that her vision of the mixed-use community, and really she kind of invented it. Planners now buy into this. It's not just libertarians. Her vision was a fairly low-rise community, not an intensive land-use community. And so I think her work kind of biased against larger cities redevelopment, which in some instances looks like it's destroying communities, but is really just creating other communities, a little harder to do.
So in her view, car beats elevator, and you say that doesn't understand how cities currently develop?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think she liked walking cities. It's feet beat elevator. But sometimes, yeah, the elevator's got to win. It gets tiresome after a few floors.
Matt Iglesias brought up something that I think gets short shrift for the broad public, but is certainly of interest to economists, and that is zoning as an impediment to the location decisions of firms and of people who might be working at those firms.
Yeah, I'm glad he brought that up. When I wrote the original book back in 1985, Economics of Zoning Laws, I viewed zoning as a metropolitan issue. That is, the suburbs were keeping the low-income people inside, and they were causing sprawl outside. But I didn't think of it as beyond a particular, you know, let Pittsburgh be Pittsburgh, let Portland be Portland was my story. And since then, particularly the work that Eddie Glaser has done at Harvard and two people who work closely with them, Peter Ganong and Danny Shoge, have pointed out that this actually has national implications. That it isn't just Silicon Valley or funny places in Sunnyvale or Arlington, Mass. That are doing crazy things. The collective effect of this is actually affects national migration, and affecting national migration from people for poor people, for middle income people, for any people who want to move from low productivity areas, from peoples where they have not much of a job, to places where there are opportunities, where businesses are expanding, where the knowledge industry is really taking off. That's extremely important in American history. I mean, I think one way I take it of it is that we don't have great national education, K-12 education. We make up for it by allowing people to move the square pegs to move to the square holes pretty easily, and then, you know, learn by doing or learn by college education. So retarding that process is really quite bad for the American economy. I think in some sense, this is what a lot of the urban economists have been pointing out to, and I'm glad Matt brought that up.
The case of Buchanan in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, Buchanan v. Worley.
This was, I'm from Louisville, and that's sort of an unpleasant chapter in Louisville's history. These were racial restrictions on buying and selling homes. But there are many legitimate reasons why people would want to make restrictions on communities?
Yeah. Buchanan v. Worley was a pre-zoning case. They looked at this new institution of zoning in Louisville wasn't the pioneer in this. Baltimore was. And they said, well, we've got all these black people moving up from the South. They want jobs. It's part of the Great Migration. But we don't want them living in our neighborhoods. And so their way of proposing to restrict this was to declare neighborhoods either white or black, predominantly white or predominantly black. And if you were predominantly one or the other, basically you had to become, you had to sell property. You didn't actually have to sell, but when you sold your property, you could only sell to black people if you were in a black neighborhood or white people if you're in a white neighborhood. So this was an early abuse of zoning. To the great credit of the U.S. Supreme Court, they struck it down, root and branch, unanimously. And to the credit of the court system in general, even the Southern courts stepped in line and said that we're not going to do that. Baltimore and Louisville had actually looked abroad to see what kind of system they could do this, and their model was South Africa. This is I call this Supreme Court decisions how apartheid did not come to America. Now, we certainly have racial segregation, but it is a much softer kind, the subtle kinds of, that just got sold or wouldn't you want to see over in this neighborhood. But we do not have that rigid legal segregation that South Africa had for so many years, and I think it spared us an enormous improved the life of blacks enormously. The other set of decisions need to be addressed is this regulatory takings doctrine. One of the proposals that I have embraced in the past was, here's how we can fight this overly restrictive zoning, this unreasonable zoning. We can say to communities, the courts should say to communities, well, that's all very good that you want to downzone this land, add restrictions to it, to 10-acre minimum lot size. But if you want to do that, Community X, you have to pay the landowners for the loss in value. Now, I think some communities might actually do that. They like their open space, and I don't have any problem with that. But many communities would say, well, maybe we have other things to do with $50 million that we'd have to pay the landowners for that. And so maybe we should adopt a more reasonable zoning standard and let some more development happen and so forth. So that's the regulatory takings approach, where the court takes the lead and says, don't treat your landowners unfairly like this, because basically the landowners who are being downzoned here are being held to a standard of providing open space that previous developers and landowners weren't. And so there's a matter of fairness and I think efficiency. The difficulty with that is there's no bottom to that bottom. That is, once you decide that you can have large-scale compensation for regulatory takings, everybody has his hand out. It is just a nonstop story. Some people think that's okay. My friend Richard Epstein thinks mostly that's okay. Richard has not made much progress on this. Even judges of my acquaintance say, we can't do that. That makes us into the National Zoning Board of Adjustment. We got other things we got to do with our time. And so it's really a standard which is I call a wonderful blackboard standard. You're standing there lecturing a class on a blackboard and you say, well, they do benefits here and costs there and they come to an equilibrium. Courts just find this entirely unmanageable.
If I understand you correctly, then torts probably not a very good replacement for much of zoning?
No, I don't think so. Zoning pretty much replaced the tort of nuisance. I mean, it's still out there, but nobody invokes it.
The mortgage interest deduction is a popular piece of, as many libertarians like to say, welfare for the middle class.
Yeah, right.
And then a lot of utilities run lines way out into communities at subsidized rates, and
mostly because they're required to do that by the state government.
They're required to do it. So, how do those impact housing decisions among Americans?
Well, my view is that they probably I agree with most economists in this, that this somewhat distorts the allocation of capital. We have too much capital in housing because housing is this seemingly free lunch for homeowners, and not enough in other industrial capital. That's the overall view of this. Of the mortgage deduction, I deal with this in the book in a gingerly way. I first point out that in the ideal world, you would allow the mortgage deduction and deduction for maintenance and property taxes and depreciation for homeowners, same as commercial developers get properly. But commercial developers pay tax on their total income. If you made homeowners pay tax on the income they pay themselves for living in their houses, all would be right with the world as far as allocation of capital is concerned. My secondary view about this, and I think I'm one of the few who's noticed this, is that this overallocation towards homeownership causes people to be too anxious about anything that affects its value. Now, you ought to be somewhat anxious about, the glue factory moving in next door, even though the glue factory developer says, "Oh, I'm really the best on the planet. It won't smell at all." You should be somewhat skeptical of that. But when somebody wants to build an apartment house 10 blocks away, and you say, "No, there might be more crime or something like that," I think that a lot of that comes back to the fact that people just have too much of their assets in housing, and we either need to reduce the size of that value, or provide some mechanisms for compensation for people who feel that who actually have lost value in their housing. There are occasional insurance schemes like this. Both of these are a little bit pie in the sky, I have to admit.
Now, we should be clear. The mortgage interest deduction is a subsidy to people who owe money on their houses, not necessarily people who might pay cash for a home.
Yeah. I'd point out, though, that I'll point out personally, I no longer have a mortgage on my house. My wife insisted we pay it off, just in case she, has to live there by herself. I'm really healthy, though. But I no longer have a mortgage. I nonetheless still receive an enormous subsidy because if I had to rent my house to myself, if my neighbor and I changed places and we each rented houses, my house would rent for, let's say, $40,000 a year or something like that. I would have to pay income tax on that rental value. I don't, because I'm basically moving the money from one pocket to the other, not past the tax man. So I'm getting an enormous subsidy. I would be getting still an additional subsidy if I had a mortgage. But really, a lot of the subsidy comes from the fact that the transaction – that I don't actually make a transaction that the IRS can grab. Now, lots of people think that's fine. we should do more of that. But it's a little bit like using barter to avoid paying taxes. The IRS does insist that if you barter your car for medical services or something like that, that both sides of that transaction should in principle, be taxed. And I think they actually do for the more elaborate schemes. I'm just thinking that maybe you should include this barter with yourself scheme in taxable income, in which case you should have mortgage deduction. It's fine. You should have property tax and depreciation deduction because you're essentially in business providing services for yourself.
We spoke about mobility earlier.
Right.
Do housing subsidies prevent or at least sort of make it harder for people to engage in the kind of mobility for economic opportunities?
I think they do, but they didn't used to. And this is the puzzle that I really wanted to address in the book. We've had zoning for 100 years. Zoning did nothing bad to American mobility for its first 60 years. Communities were zoned. There was loss of home ownership. It blossomed after World War II. People moved along like crazy. It wasn't really a problem. It really only became a problem in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when people became hyper aware of the effect of land use regulation on the value of their own homes and stepped up to the plate and said, no, I've got to participate in the hearings. No, I need to preserve that wetland. This hyper awareness that has made mobility, that made housing values go up in desirable areas of the country so much and productive areas of the country so much, that's retarding the mobility of people in ways that it didn't used to. It's not inevitable in other words, I want to say it's not homeownership itself. We just have too much homeownership. As the usual economist says, there's can be too much of a good thing.
One of the arguments that Randall O'Toole here at the Cato Institute makes, and perhaps a few other economists, is that the housing crisis was in part driven by housing markets that were highly restricted.
My mentor at Princeton, Ed Mills, subscribes to that 100%. I have to say I don't know enough to be able to assent to that, but the argument is out there. The only reason we had this enormous housing bubble, which burst in such catastrophic ways, was because the supply was so unreasonably restricted. I agree that the supply was unreasonably restricted, but I want to beg off from the chain of events that would require that this, you know, caused the Great Recession.
William Fishel is author of Zoning Rules, The Economics of Land Use Regulation. Watch or listen to a forum for the book at cato.org.